Hello, and welcome to the Mayo Report on the Comic Book Page podcast. My name is John Mayo. In this episode, we'll be discussing the top 300 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month. In this episode, we're going to be talking about the numbers for the trade sales. Let's see, the top 300 trades sales. Man, that's getting hard to say, and I've been doing it for a while. I should have this down. For April 2018, is sold through Diamond to retailers in the direct market. This obviously does not include things going through, I think Barnes & Noble is the only major bookseller standing. I guess Books A Million. Or Amazon or Walmart or any other places one might find trade paperbacks other than a comic book store. But this covers, you know, a decent percentage of the sales, and I think is one of the guiding forces as to what gets collected, what keeps in print, and such like that, for the comic book marketplace. We're in that transition period where we've got, the regular suspects for the premier publishers, plus Dynamite and Boom have moved into that position in previews. The sales for the first couple of months where they're in the premier section of previews haven't rolled out, but I'm going ahead and treating them as if they are premier publishers, just for the sake of comparison or whatnot. I do have the top 500 sales. We will be limiting it to the 300 when doing comparisons on an aggregate level from month to month, just because it's apples to apples for a longer period of time.
Mm-hmm.
This time around, Marvel had the majority of the sales for the top 300 units. They had 26.74% of the units, 31.37% of the dollars. Image was not that far behind them in terms of units with 26.12% of the units. They were fairly far behind in terms of dollars with 19.11% of the total dollars for the top 300 trades. DC was a little behind in terms of units with 24.11% of the units, but not that far behind Marvel with 30.25% of the dollars.
Yeah. And you can kind of see that reasoning in the average price per unit, you know, $10 cheaper for Image on average than the other two in there, within a couple, you know, almost less than a dollar between Marvel and DC in terms of the average price for their for what they're dispensing this month.
Well, and I think two things factor in to make that happen. One, Image is really good about having those initial trades being at a lower price point to get people on board with a new series. I think that's just a good idea in general. The other thing is both DC and Marvel tend to be doing more of those higher-end format items at the over the $100 price point.
Yeah, given their history, they're much more likely to have Omnibuy and other large, you know, kind of coffee table books, which obviously have higher MSRPs for sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, just think about it. There are things like The Walking Dead, Invincible, etc. Yeah. How many Image titles have enough material to fill up an Omnibuy?
Yeah, that is a very good point. And it more and more, you know, we used to talk about, there used to be, before Image kind of really blossomed in the last 5 to 7 years, used to be that the pinnacle of creator-owned, and even though it's partially creator-owned, was a 60-issue run at Vertigo, right?
Yeah.
And things like The Sandman, you had Preacher, you had Jason Aaron's Scalped, you know, that 60-issue run at Vertigo used to be kind of like, you knew you had made it when you were able to do that. Now I think even at Image, if you could get 30 issues out of a series, that's like your grandpa mode. You know what I mean?
Well, it's funny because I think there are some where the length of story they have is only so long.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like the Luna Brothers with the girls, I think that was 24 issues or something.
Mm-hmm.
But they said what they had to say and they were done.
Yeah.
Same with Terry Moore and a lot of his titles like Echo and things like that were, again, to that 30, 40, somewhere in that ballpark. I mean, not the 5-plus-year run or epic runs that some other people have had, but that's what they set out to do.
Mm-hmm.
There are others where they set out to do the epic run and they just didn't make it.
Oh, absolutely.
And I don't know if either is better than the other. I'd actually prefer when they set out to do a finite, if lengthy, series and make it, because then you get the beginning, middle, and end that they had envisioned, versus somebody's trying to do that long haul and the sales just aren't there for them, and they have to cut it short. I don't think that does anybody any good.
Well, and I think that there's an interesting paradigm shift in some ways due to the way that the market operates nowadays. you used to see, you know, like I said, these creators that had this long arcing story that they wanted to tell, and that they would, you know, either have publisher support or the market would support a long run. Now what you see is creators who have a very solid idea. They do the first 4 to 6 issues as a kind of contained story. And then if sales justify it, they have almost an expanded universe they expand into. So I know Jeff Lemire has talked on numerous podcasts that I've listened to, the stuff he's doing with Black Hammer. He has, you know, when he was initially doing it, you know, wasn't sure if it was going to be successful. So he had maybe, you know, 12 issues mapped out, you know, 2 6 issue runs, or, you know, 3 5 issue, you know, trades, kind of, that's how they think of them in story arcs. And then as it when it became obvious that it was going to be successful and the company was willing to back it, you know, Dark Horse, he obviously wrote a bunch of like side, you know, basically like all the main characters get their own little like side project, you know what I mean? And so
yeah,
it's almost like it's become compartmentalized, and each segment has to prove itself a lot of the same ways that Mike Mignola for BPRD became a series of miniseries. Now, because of his, like, you know, because of his breadth of publishing, if one series isn't doing as well as others, he can use the other money from that to subsidize, you know, so he can kind of keep the machine going. But for creators that don't have that back history, I think they really do have to do 4 to 6 issues at a time and say, is this working? Great, I can keep expanding it. Almost kind of like a shared universe within a creator's own mind, like a Star Wars or a Star Trek, where if this is successful, we'll keep doing it. And I'll just keep adding chunks on into each side, like a tree with branches. And if not, then we, you know, the story's over at issue 6. You know,
it's funny you say all that, because when I was recording with James on the Weekly Comic Spotlight, he was asking kind of what I thought of like Marvel's season mentality.
Uh-huh.
And I told him, I do think there's a rationale for, much like what you were saying, of having that regular checkpoint of, let's tell a story of a certain, you know, 4 or 6 issue length, whatever. If sales are still there, we'll tell another arc.
Mm-hmm.
Because it always sucks when a creator gets to the point of having to cut something short. Mm-hmm. And it's one thing when it happens on a creator-owned project, because then they just kind of wind things down and they're done.
Yeah.
What we've seen, on the other hand, at Marvel and DC in a shared universe, where they've gotten to play with the toys, but just not long enough, we've seen a couple of creators kind of tease us with, here are the next 8 arcs I was going to do if I'd had the time.
Right.
The example I used with James was, I think, James Robinson on Justice League, where his final issue, I swear, had like 8 or 9 splash pages, which were essentially a story arc compressed down to, and this is the adventure we had that we didn't have time to tell you about.
Yeah. Well, and that writer has another perfect example. Do you think his Starman, you know, that's one of the things he's most known for. Do you think that could get published today? Heck no. There's no way you could have that long of a run. It's like 5, you know, 300 page hardcovers. There's no way he could have got that many issues in today's market. You know what I mean?
I was surprised he got the 12 issue run for Shade at the start of the New 52.
And I love that series. I'm a huge Shade. I like that character because it's so weird. But yeah, no, like, I mean, that's just kind of my inevitable lot in life. I love all the weird independent characters, and they always get cut short. But, you know, Starman is one of my absolute favorite series. And I just think, you know, there was a lot of storytelling that kind of developed over time with that, and that the relationship and the story, you know, between the father and the son. And it's just, you know, sometimes I wonder if we're, you know, I kind of got reintroduced back into comics after I went away from it. You know, I graduated high school in 1999, and that's right when I stopped reading comics for about, oh, I want to say like 10 years-ish. And what got me back was Vertigo, you know, those long Vertigo series. And I really just, I got into Sandman, and I got into Preacher, and then I just couldn't stop Why the Last Man. And I just read all the classics, you know, 100 Bullets. I read all those, and it really like supercharged my, you know, re-brought me back in. So it's interesting to see, you know, some of those stories were really paid off because they had so much runway, you know?
Well, I think Vertigo is one of the few examples where I think kind of brand loyalty makes a lot of sense, because Karen Berger built up a large library of projects through Vertigo by picking the right creators and just getting some phenomenal work out of them and giving them the freedom to do what they wanted to do, whatever, and the guidance they needed. And it seemed like a really good mix of editorial oversight when it seemed to be needed, or maybe didn't seem to be needed from a reader point of view, but may have been from a creator point of view, but not editorial interference.
Uh-huh.
Because you look at that run of stuff from the foundation of Vertigo up until her departure there. And yeah, there were a couple of misfires here and there that just didn't hook with the audience or whatever, but Sandman, Swamp Thing, Animal Man. Animal Man's an interesting case, because that was, as you were talking about, hey, tell a four-issue story and see if it's got legs. It's exactly what they did. It was a four-issue mini-series that went for, now granted, Grant Morrison was off after a while, but I think that thing went 100-some-odd issues, you know? So if you've got something that's working, keep it going and stuff. And then you've got, you know, Why the Last Man? You've got so many other fables. Go-to examples of things at Vertigo that are different projects but have a similar enough sensibility that if you like one, you're probably going to like a lot of the others. Mm-hmm. And if you find an editor or publisher or imprint that's greenlighting projects you like, stick with it. You know, I'm curious, because she's now over at, is it Dark Horse, I think it is? Or what? Yeah. I'm curious if she can kind of build up a similar library of well-respected titles and stuff like that over there.
Yeah, it will be interesting to see, you know, kind of the second act. And I wonder if in this environment that you're able to build a stable with the market. There's so much fickleness in the single issue reader, and there's a minimum amount of single issues that for the most of the publishers have to sell to be a financially, you know, forward going thing. And I just don't know, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's an incredibly competitive market, and the approach of telling a trade paperback length arc, serializing into individual issues, is rough because it may read as a good totality. But man, if people don't like that first issue, if you didn't start out strong enough, they're not going to come back for that second. You don't have enough people coming back. Sure, you'll get the first trade because that's almost a given, mm-hmm. but you may not get the content for the second.
Yeah.
It's a really rough marketplace, and I don't see it getting any easier anytime soon, nor do I think it necessarily should, but I think the way that creators and editors are putting their stories together, they need to take a bit of a look at that and make sure that they're starting out strong and keeping the individual issue in that serialized market in mind and keeping those readers convinced that they should come back for that next issue. Mm-hmm. And doing it for the right reasons, not a, well, crap, I didn't get the full story, I gotta come back just to recoup my investment on this or something.
Yeah.
You know, there's good incentive and there's bad incentive. And obviously, I like the good incentive. Go figure.
Yeah.
So Marvel, DC, Image, that accounts for like almost 77% of the units sold in the top 300 this month, leaving everybody else fighting for the rest. Viz did the best of the rest with 3.74% of the units, followed very closely by Boom, 3.71% of the units, Dark Horse, 3.28% of the units, IDW, 2.48%, we then have Random House and Valiant, and then we get to our final premier publisher with Dynamite there at 1.03% of the units. And, you know, all said and done, that those couple of publishers, even if we include Random House and Valiant, we're talking only about under 17% of the total units sold. Mm-hmm. Everybody else, again, fighting for table scraps of just maybe they got a trade out there, maybe they got two or something like that. In some cases, even four or five, just not enough to have a big share of the units. Mm-hmm. Now, to put this into context, the total number of units this time around for the top 300 was 317,965 units, a little under 318,000 units. And we've got how many publishers? We've got, what, 27 publishers on the list this time? So it's very lopsided. You got Marvel, DC, Image, which on the trade side this month playing pretty evenly, and then everybody else, you know, a significant ways behind with, you know, like an eighth of the sales at best, sometimes a pittance of the sales. Mm-hmm. Marvel had a little over 85,000 units. The bottom item on the list, Cartoon Books, had 331 units. So we're talking not only orders of magnitude difference there, but just a huge difference in sales level.
Yeah.
Which isn't too surprising, because a lot of those publishers at that lower end of the spectrum here, much more niche-type properties. In some cases, some of these things are fairly new. In other cases, they've been around for a while. But there's only so many people that are aware of them and going to buy them, and that influences what the stores carry.
Yeah.
And that's where I think a fundamental improvement could be made in sales is if there was some way to do better matchmaking between the reader who wants something and the store having it. Because until somebody walks into a store, there's no reason for the store to think they're going to sell any particular item. And I know when I go into a store, it's not like I'm wearing a billboard that's saying, hey, these are the items I'm willing to go buy if you happen to have them. Even if I did something crazy like that, it's not like they've had time to go pre-order them, get them in, and have them ready for me. Yeah. It's just, it's potluck sometimes.
Yeah, and that's what makes, you know, unfortunately, you know, single issues is not an issue. But for trades, that's what makes Amazon so dangerous is, you know, someone who goes into a direct market store, and obviously because of the way that the contracts between the publishers or the distributor and the store is, the store has to take all the risk because it's a non-returnable item. So the stores don't stock everything and they can't anticipate someone brand new coming in and knowing what they want, right? Or it's very difficult to. And so when they inevitably don't have something in stock and tell them it'll take a week or two to get it, and then they, well, the person can pull out their smartphone and order on Amazon and have it delivered the next day. You know, it's problematic.
Well, and add in digital to that, because some of the trades that have come out, including one or two that I think are on the list this time, not only were they available digitally, they were available digitally at 99 cents for the trade.
Yeah.
A comic store, other than the fact it's got it in the physical format, cannot compete with that on price, certainly.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's just a bad situation all the way around. And if I felt that it was bringing in new readers from, say, the movies or TV shows or something like that and getting them firmly into the hobby, I still think it sucks for the retailer, but it'd at least be a little bit more palatable. I just don't know that that's what's happening.
Yeah. It's very opaque in terms of the... Unfortunately, I think when Marvel was the premier publisher that got kind of in trouble with that a little bit recently. And I think the thing that people in the comics world don't understand is the contracts that the publishers have with Amazon, depending on how good they were negotiated, they oftentimes are just negotiated like the Amazon has with the book publishers. And the contracts, this has been going on for about 10 years with the regular, you know, prose book publishers, where Amazon, no matter what price it charges you, it still pays the publisher the quoted price that they want. So if a book is $9.99, Amazon is supposed to give the publisher 70%. They would give the publisher $7, even if they only charge the customer $1.99. Now, Amazon uses that primarily as promotion because for the most of their business in the last 25 years, they've been about growing market share and not making profits. Now, some of that is changing due to their, you know, web service stuff like that. But a lot of times they're doing loss leading. Now, in a small industry like comics, just like when you go to the grocery store and they do loss leaders like milk and eggs to get you in the door to buy higher profitable stuff, comics is so niche that a lot of times when you see that, you're right. For the direct market, it can look pretty bad in comparison to selling a book for 99 cents digitally that you're selling for $24.99 in the store. But that Amazon has been doing loss leading discounts on books for a very long time, and graphic novels to them are nothing more than books with pictures. And it's tough sometimes. I just see a lot of comments on the comics interwebs, and people just don't understand how Amazon works and how the contracts that these companies have signed. They think that Amazon is doing this just because they want to. No, it's because the publishers, when they signed those contracts, gave Amazon those rights. Now, they can, going forward, renegotiate those contracts. But the reality is Amazon has the right to discount those books. And guess what? Marvel is getting $9 or $10 or whatever from those books, even if Amazon is charging 99 cents. It may look bad to the direct market, but don't let Marvel and DC tell you they're not getting paid anything either.
I think the difference, though, is I would be surprised. I would have been shocked if this had happened with DC.
Yeah, no, I'm just saying, like, Marvel's the one that got caught with their pants down. But in terms of the, and maybe DC did negotiate better contracts, but you know what I mean? Like, in terms of the Amazon negotiates it as if it was a book.
Absolutely.
And they're able to do this. It's just like a loss leader at a grocery store, just like for Amazon. And that's the other thing too, is Amazon's able to do this because each part of their business is an overall small part of their business. So they're not taking huge losses for long periods of time. You know, the total amount of books they sell is maybe like 5% of their revenue, you know, versus everything else. So they can afford to do it. Whereas, like, obviously a direct market comic store, that is very hard to compete against, if not impossible, because that's your main product.
I think, though, the difference between Marvel and DC in this sort of a situation is DC is much better about partnering with the retail community. They seem, I don't say protective of it, but certainly not trying to undercut it. Whereas Marvel has done many things in the past that this would fall into in line with as a pattern of behavior, where they're not being as protective or partnering with the retailers as well, and have actively undercut them.
Oh, and I completely agree in the sense that from my perspective, Marvel has always been about maximizing revenue and profit, and that may have led them to negotiate deals where Amazon was willing to give them a better revenue and profit deal, but they required them to be allowed to discount. Whereas DC said, I will not take as much percent, but I get the ultimate say in terms of loss leading discount. You know what I mean? So like that's part of that contract negotiation. And absolutely DC with some of their higher ups may have been thinking about, well, I need to shield the direct market from some of this while still making a good business decision with Amazon. Whereas Marvel said, column A says I can make 20% and column B says I can make 25%. I'm going to make 20. You know what I mean?
Like, oh, absolutely. And I think that's a lot of it is Marvel is, this is more profitable. Let's do the more profitable. And they're a business. That's what they're there to do. DC, however, takes that longer look.
Yeah.
And says, yeah, column B may get me more money right now. It's short-term gain, but long-term damage.
Yeah.
And if this were to somehow happen to DC, because it absolutely could, left hand doesn't know what the right hand's doing or whatever, a mistake it's made, what have you. I think Dan Didio would be able to tell the retailer community, this was a mistake. It's not good for you guys. We agree with that. We're sorry. We will make this right. And yeah. Be believed on that.
Oh, and I agree with you. But guess what? Just like any large corporation, leadership can be changed. What if Ike Perlmutter was put in charge of DC? You know what he does at Marvel. Can you imagine what he does at DC?
Well, and that's very true, because it wouldn't take much of a regime change over at DC, even if it's above kind of the publisher editorial staff, that changes how they do business. And it could have incredible ramifications on the comic market. Mm-hmm. We've got the DC Universe online service coming up, and if they decide for whatever reason we want to do a Digital Comics Unlimited sort of a thing, as well as cartoons, movies, TV shows, that kind of stuff, that becomes a game changer. Mm-hmm. You know, as to how quickly and how severe, I don't know. But I've got to imagine that if DC got somebody in power that was as forward-thinking digitally and internet savvy and stuff as some of the people they've had at Marvel, where they've had the Digital Comics Unlimited, they've had the Marvel API just for sharing information about their books and such. If DC were to go down a similar path, things change radically.
Absolutely.
And sooner or later, everyone who's in power at any of these companies, they'll retire, die, move on, whatever. And somebody else will come into play and the game changes. Mm-hmm. So we'll see what happens with all of that. But it's just, we're seeing a little bit of shift in the market because of, again, the previews shuffling, putting Image in a better place, moving Boom and Dynamite forward, splitting DC out to another previews. Haven't seen any of the ramifications of that yet. Maybe there'll be major ones. Maybe there won't be. Don't know. But it's one of the things that does make doing the talk about the numbers so interesting over the long haul is things keep changing.
Yeah. And I will say, because I'm sure I'll get some comments from the readers about like, well, this is slightly different in terms of the steep discounting. One thing I will say that does reflect poorly on Marvel or Amazon, whoever was pushing this, probably more on Marvel because Amazon doesn't care. But one thing I can completely understand about the retailers being up in arms is that in the book trade, the prose book trade, when Amazon does the steep discounting, it's often for books in a series, and it's right before a new book comes out, the previous book or the books previous to that, you know, if it's book 10 in a series, books 1 through 8 will go on sale, yada, yada, yada. What this was is it was day and date, 99 cent on the same day or even before that the $24.99 trade version hit the direct market. So that I can understand being upset in is that, look, if you want to discount back issues or back, previously published trades, that's one thing, because you've had the direct market has had the opportunity to, you know, reap the benefit of new stuff coming out. But if you're going to discount to 99 cents, a 400 page trade that just came out that my cover price is $39.99 the day it came out, that is very, very, very difficult. You know, I recognize that portion of it.
Well, and one of the particular items that I believe was discounted was the Thanos Infinity Siblings original graphic novel. Hardcover, $24.99, original material.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah.
And doing that for 99 cents versus, you know, $25, it's like if somebody is price sensitive, and let's face it, with the way prices are on comics, a lot of people are, most, I think.
Well, and even if you're not necessarily price sensitive, that drastic of a price difference has the potential to not necessarily, like, you know, if you're wealthy, and, you know, it doesn't matter, that's one thing. But most people that read comics, you know, in general, that's such a huge price difference that even if you're not, like, even if it doesn't bother you to pay $24.99, you might start thinking, like, what is wrong with this, the model of how this works? Like, you know, it might start, you may create a general sense of unease or distrust. It just be like, what am I doing here? Why am I paying this when it's a dollar here? And I don't know. It just creates, yeah.
It raises questions that are best not raised.
Yeah, exactly.
Any of the ilk of, why the hell am I spending so much on this? Yeah. No good comes from that for the publisher.
Especially in a small little market, when, you know, we talk about this because we're like, oh, look at all this, and it's like these are dimes compared to some of the other entertainment industries. You know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. I think and again, Thanos Infinity Siblings, its sales were, let's see, 5,760 units. Now, I don't know how many people are needed to make a modern big budget motion picture or something. And I'm sure it's not 5,000 people, but it's at least, I don't know, maybe 1,000 or something.
Uh-huh.
And that's to make the thing, much less how many people go see a big budget movie or a TV show, whatever. So yeah, we're talking in, you know, orders of magnitude smaller than a movie, TV, video games, etc. But for a retailer that said, hey, this is Jim Starlin, Alan Davis, they're coming back, they're doing Thanos is hot, there's the Infinity War movie and stuff like that with the Avengers. This is a great time. I'm going to order heavy on this because I think it'll sell. As you're pulling it out of the box, you're reading stuff on the internet saying, yeah, it's available for 99 cents elsewhere. I can't imagine anyone thinking, wow, that's wonderful, I'm so happy, as a retailer.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So that's, again, not a good way to treat a retail partner. And again, Marvel's got an unfortunate history with that, to the point of even being sued by retailers when they were violating their own trade sales agreements.
Yeah.
That's not the reputation you want to have with the people who you're dependent on to help sell your material. Mm-hmm. But that is the history that's out there.
Absolutely.
Now, in some months, that Infinity Siblings with the 5,700 plus units might have topped the list, not this month and not by a long shot. Two items are above it, immediately above it, in rank number two is Paper Girls Volume 4 trade paperback, 9,721 units, which of course is really strong. Go figure, it's a Image title, it's well respected. Even that is almost a drop in the bucket compared to the number one item of Action Comics 80 Years of Superman hardcover, 18,641 units. I think there are two or three titles that might have been able to have beaten this out had they been released in the same month. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking specifically maybe a new volume of Saga or certainly Walking Dead would have had a chance.
Mm-hmm.
Although even then, I don't know that it's guaranteed.
Oh, absolutely not. And I think one thing that when I saw these numbers, one thing I thought of was that this is the type of trade that the comic store may be thinking, well, I initially probably will only sell one or two of these at the beginning, but maybe in order to jazz up demand, DC offered a very good discount. This is the type of item which you can keep for years and it will be able to sell. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's an anniversary kind of thing, so you won't need to worry about it being dated within 6 months.
Yes.
It won't turn, you know how, like, you know, before the new 52, now all those trades are almost really hard to sell because we have, you know, the new version of the DC world. So those trades almost become radioactive, whereas this will relatively be able to sit on the shelf next to things. I'm not in any way saying that the quality of it is as good, but it can sit next to Watchmen and you won't worry about the version of Watchmen, you know, going stale. You won't worry about this going stale.
Well, yeah, exactly. It's not like next year there's going to be Action Comics 81 Years of Superman.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm sure that, you know, in hoping to get as big a print run as possible to lower cost, DC probably gave retailers a good incentive to order the first run. You know what I mean? Like, maybe more than the 50% off they do, 55, 60. And so retailers like, well, I can realistically sell two. Maybe I'm going to order 10 because I know over the next couple of years I'm going to sell these and I'm going to make profit because I got a better discount. You know what I mean?
Yeah, we've got no way of knowing that. It is the number one retail rank as well as the number one quantity rank. But it was so far above everything else in terms of units that even if they did discount it, it was still the most profitable thing.
Yeah, for sure.
And I think it's got, I'm going to say maybe a 20-year shelf life, because I do think once Action Comics 100 Years of Superman comes out,
there you go,
that may make this feel a little dated.
Yeah, so I think the stores could feel reasonable in ordering a few extra copies that they didn't assume they could sell within 6 months, you know?
Yeah, because let's face it, how many of the current comic stores are likely to be around in 20 years?
Yeah, good. The industry may not be around, John. So, yeah, good point.
you say that, but I've been thinking that for at least 20 years.
And notice how I said industry, not comics. Comics will be around. They just may be like, if the direct market crashes, it may just be web comics and whatever the big two publish through their Marvel Unlimited version of apps. You know, like, I'm not claiming that comics are going to go. I'm saying the direct market, the weird way that we sell comics.
Well, let's talk about that a little further. Certainly, graphic storytelling of words with pictures and stuff will be around forever.
Yeah, if it was in the cave paintings in France, then it's going to be around after the apocalypse, so it'll be around.
Yeah, but is comics as we think of them of 8 to 20 page or more of serialized narrative story, that kind of a thing, is that going to be around 20 years from now?
It's interesting you say that. Look what Lazarus is doing. Look what Astro City is doing. Look where we're headed on some of those, especially creator owns, where they can't justify the costs of 20 page issues.
Let's now roll back to, I'm going to say 20-ish years ago. I don't remember the exact date, but at one point Diamond had come out with, you know, if you're not selling $2,500 worth of stuff, it's not worth it for us to carry it. We're just not going to carry stuff. That was the point at which Claypool went from doing comics to being pretty much online only. Mm-hmm. Other publishers went straight to trade on that stuff. I think, and I could be misremembering on this, this might have been around the time and reason that Phil Foglio took some of his stuff, Girl Genius, I think it was, or whatever, straight to trades and stuff.
Yep. And they serialize all their stuff online first, yeah.
So this isn't the first time we've had this sort of a push that we're seeing with things like Lazarus and Astro City. Mm-hmm. And we have not seen the industry go lock, stock, and barrel to trades, although at one point it did look like that was the direction.
Yeah. And I think just like anything, this is there's so much entrenchment in certain aspects of the business model that any sort of change like that will be somewhat gradual. And as long as the higher ends of the corporations are willing to back the publishing machine, it still is probably pretty affordable for DC and Marvel because they print at such volume, you know what I mean? They get such good rates to continue this model. It will be interesting, though, if DC ever does get a DC Unlimited. That, I think, has some solid potential to make some real changes.
Well, how much of what they're publishing do they perhaps need to maintain the volume for their printing contracts?
Yeah. I don't know. If you ask Marvel, they seem to print like 100 series a month, so it seems to be a lot.
And I do wonder if the Netflix model is going to be the future of comics at some point, where Digital Comics Unlimited from Marvel, a DC equivalent, if that becomes how people get their comics.
Yeah, well, and I think something that will slow that transition, if that were to happen, there are a significant number of people, and I wouldn't necessarily presume that you would be one of them, especially in your age bracket. You know, we talk all the time about, where are all the young readers coming for comics? Where are all the young readers? And we talk about this, you know, are the big two just marketing to the 40-plus-year-olds white men who read comics? Those people would be the most unlikely to switch to, I think, the complete digital unlimiteds. Now, some of them will switch just because of money, but I think that those people's unwillingness, they really like their paper single comics. I think those people will keep the industry going, but in what complete form? You know what I mean?
I wonder about the future of this, because I think with DC moving a lot of their comics up to the $3.99 price point, that we are seeing pushback on that. It's like, hey, this is more expensive to do that. I got to drop this. Mm-hmm. At what point does it push people towards trades because they're just the better deal in some cases?
Yeah.
And when do you hit kind of a breaking point where you can't really charge any more for a single issue, yet you've got to get the single issues out to recoup the cost to get to the trade?
Yeah, that may become like a business model. Like there's a formula, and once you break the formula, then you really do have to make some changes regardless of what the audience wants. You know what I mean? Because almost like would they go to the European Band-Aid Dessiné model where it's like once every 3 months you get 48 pages, you know what I mean? Or whatever, however often they publish. I don't know.
Well, and it's a bizarre, or not bizarre, but a complex calculation between price and value. Whereas again, like a $9.99 Saga Volume 1 there at rank 4, that's a great value for that price. Not so much if you'd gotten the original issues, of course, which I did, of course. but having that price-benefit ratio working out, having that frequency where it's not too frequently, but it's frequently enough, you remember to go get that next volume. Mm-hmm. Because when I was in college, I would go hit the bookstores, Barnes & Noble and Borders or whatever was around at the time, and I'd just go through their sci-fi section. I was reading a lot of the Star Trek novels, some other sci-fi series, and there was usually a book a week of interest to me because it was a better time for publishing. And that goes to people in my age bracket, I believe is how you phrased that, as to how long ago that was.
Yeah, no, I know what you mean, though.
But these days, it's not that way. So if you were to be used to going to the bookstore every week to pick up a sci-fi novel and you're getting to where 3 out of 4 weeks you come out empty-handed, it's harder to go back that fourth week. And I wonder, with comics, if we were to go to... And again, we're seeing some experimentation with this with things like Mystic U, where it was a bi-monthly larger format book, and I think it benefited the storytelling there. But does bi-monthly work as well? I mean, quarterly can work. It can also be the kiss of death. It depends how accessible the stories are and if the writers are really up to keeping the story momentum towards a very satisfying read and enough so that you're thinking, wow, I got to go order that next one. Mm-hmm. And I really think that we're perpetually at that next tipping point. We haven't tipped in any particular direction yet, be it trades take over, digital takes over, or you know what, we don't need any of this, we're good with the movies and TV. I don't know where the stuff is heading. And it, you know, I look at these sales, and if you think there are around 3,000 physical stores that we would walk into and think this is a legit comic store, meaning they've got enough of the new material out there, it'd be worth having going there every week to go get your comic fix, they've got the trades, whatever. Maybe they've got games, maybe they don't, maybe they're mainly games or whatever, but enough comics that we would say, yes, they're not dabbling in this, they're taking it seriously. If there are 3,000 of those stores, only 16 items on this list of trades had a chance of getting into every one of those. Mm-hmm. And there are a couple of, well, actually, most of between rank 17 and 24 is Saga, but go figure.
I was actually going to make that point. In the top 25, every version, every volume of Saga is reordered. That is amazing.
I'm not sure to attribute that to either.
Yeah, because usually they're more spread out over the, you know, you'll see some of those reorders in the, you know, into the 30s, 40s, 100s, you know, 200s, depending on what volume needs to be reprinted. I do not know if Image was trying to clear its warehouse a little bit and sweeten the pot on some of that reorder. If you reorder them all, you get like 10% extra off or what. But it is strange to see that many grouped up there, right? Because Saga came out. Like months ago, so I don't know what that is.
I think they are discounted a bit looking at the retail ranking. So I do think it may have been a little bit of an inventory clear out or whatever. As usual, we see kind of that V formation of the volumes, where if you were to chart the sales this month, you would have had the high points being the beginning and the ending of the run, and then dropping down to a middle point with volume 4 being that low point. Mm-hmm. So it goes from 1 down to 4 and then starts going back up with 5, 6, 7, and 8. And again, to me, that's just a factor of new readers coming in and readers catching up or whatever. Mm-hmm. It comes down to the more volumes you get out there, the harder it is for readers to stay current.
That is true. Look at Walking Dead.
Yeah. What's interesting, though, is we used to see this sort of almost evergreen title on the trades list a lot more, where we would have had the full run of either Sandman or Walking Dead or Fables or things of that sort, mm-hmm. Left, right, and center. And we're really not getting that these days. Mm-hmm. So I think it comes down to your comment about it's a fickle marketplace. I mean, there's no argument about that whatsoever. It's competitive. It's hard for something to stay on the list. Do we hit a saturation point where, you know, people have discovered Walking Dead? You know, yeah, there are people coming of age and getting into the hobby, but not enough so to make a huge dent in the list.
Yeah.
And that influx of readers kind of is and isn't needed. Again, once somebody's got it in their collection, there's really no incentive to go buy another copy. But also, once certain titles end, like with Invincible, that kind of kills interest in it. There's nothing sustaining it. The individual issues were almost marketing for the trade.
Uh-huh.
But even with Walking Dead, of course, we still got the issues coming out. It's not the sales juggernaut it was at one point, where Kirkman would account for an overwhelming percentage of the sales for Image on a month-to-month basis on the trade side.
Yeah.
But of course, he's made the money, so he's not doing too bad. And he's got the TV show. But it's a little odd that publishers feel the need to put everything in trade, yet retailers don't feel the need to pick up most of it in trade. There's a bit of a dichotomy there, and if I were a publisher, I would certainly put the stuff out in trade, because while I've got the content, for the cost of essentially stitching together the PDF files or whatever digital format they're in, mm-hmm. slapping a new cover on it, getting a new an ISBN, a price point, maybe a fresh cover or use one from the series, or you know, a little bit of production work, you've got a new thing that's more likely to hit that long tail of now it's available on Amazon and things like that. So from a publisher point of view, I get there's virtually no reason not to collect everything into trade. But we see so few of these doing particularly well
mm-hmm.
that something's wrong with the model in that respect. It doesn't have the collectability aspect of individual comics. I get that, and I'm okay with that. But is it that there's too much material coming out, or why are so many of these trades just kind of coming out to low sales and then just kind of vanishing?
Yeah.
And again, there are a couple of these. It's like, wow, I really wouldn't have even greenlit the monthly issues, much less a trade on this. But if you've got the monthly issues, do the trade. I get it. But others, it's like, it was doing okay. It didn't sell well out on the trade side. Because you know a decent percentage of some of these items, we go to a convention, we're going to see at 50% off or $5 for the trade or something like that.
Oh, absolutely.
So there's more material than is needed, but it's still coming out. I'm not seeing the trades going up in sales as a result of price hikes or disillusionment with delays on individual issues or anything like that. If anything, I think the trade sales on average, or not on average, but for the majority of cases, is soft or just downright squishy. Whereas again, you've got some things that are doing well. We've got so many things that are doing just pedestrian to, well, that was disappointing. That's part of why I don't see trades as the next major revenue stream for comics.
And yeah, I can see that perspective, but I almost wonder if this is a lagging symptom of what we have discussed in the past. There's too many, and you could argue with me about this, but there's too many comics being published. There's not enough demand for all these comics, and they're not selling well. But then you could also argue as well, who should get to decide which, you know, what if I like these types of comics? Because obviously, I'm the first one that says I'm not a huge fan of all the stuff that DC and Marvel put out. I prefer independent books. But a lot of the independent books I read don't last very long because they don't sell very well. So, you know, when we see the trades not sell well, it's almost like the business model has been created. They have to do the trades to even come close to breaking even or making a little bit of money. So it's kind of like baked in order to actually the area where you'd have to actually make tough decisions is on whether to publish a series at all. But then you get into this question of, do you want to have these monocultures where the only the top five publishers can afford to publish series, and you get just superhero comics? You know what I mean? That becomes tough.
Yeah, it's, and just to weigh in on, are there too many comics right now? I'm sitting here with a stack of, I don't know, 300-400 to read. So yeah, there are.
Well, you just need to clone yourself, John. That's the key.
Yeah, that would help. That way I could talk to myself about comics.
Yeah, you could break them up into stacks of 100, and you could assign everyone a room, and they go in there and they read their comics, and then they come out, and you can just share that experience.
This is where if I could do the whole Jamie Madrox multiple man kind of a thing.
Yeah, right?
I could stay up on the comics. It's what's needed.
When you pack your suitcase for San Diego, instead of clothes, just pack it with hundreds of comics that you need to read as you travel.
Yeah, it's just I don't really have the time to read on the trip is the problem.
Yeah, no, I know.
Well, I think there's there's too much coming out. There's not enough differentiation between a lot of these things. And a lot of these things are getting such a ho-hum reception that when the trade comes out, there's not a lot of people saying, oh man, you've got to read that.
Yeah.
It's like, and yeah, it came out.
I wonder if, you know, when we often talk about there being too much, a lot of people will focus on, you know, there's six X books, there's, you know, three or four Spider-Mans at all time, maybe more. There's, you know, along the lines, there's like, you know, a number of different, you know, not necessarily main Batman titles, but they're publishing like, you know, Batman and then Detective Comics, but then they've got like three or four miniseries about Batman going on. And I know Batman's its own special world. So actually, the honest truth is that the Batman sales haven't been bad enough to where you would say they're oversaturating, because it seems like there's this weird unlimited black hole ability to always dump more Batman into the market. But in terms of like for some of Marvel, you know, people complain there's too many different, you know, there's four or five books in each line. If they were publishing less, do you think the sales would just be less and people would try other books? Or do you think that this is just the way it is? You're marketing to smaller and smaller niche communities. Yes, there are 6X books, but maybe there are certain aspects of it. Certain people only want to read certain ones. So if you only cut it down to two, maybe you wouldn't have that many more sales. They'd start out okay, but then they'd fall off just like everything else.
I think if you were to do less comics, you would sell less comics. There's fewer things out there to go buy, okay? Mm-hmm. But I do think that there's a different approach they could be taking to some of these titles. Let's use the X-Men for example. There's X-Men Gold, Red, Blue, and Astonishing.
There's no Aquamarine? Where's the X-Men Aquamarine?
Give it time. It's funny because if you replace gold with yellow, it's pretty much the main three colors of the Power Rangers, but go figure.
There you go.
If they would at least have the X in the corresponding color on all the costumes, or maybe they do and I just haven't noticed. Because I can't tell while I'm reading one which color I'm reading for the most part. I know which groups are which title, but still. If they were to do a main weekly X book, and that's kind of that backbone thing, but then as a couple of characters break out and say, I've got this mission we're going to go do, and they've still got enough to keep that main weekly book going, that mission goes out and it becomes a one-shot or a mini-series or a weekly mini-series or whatever.
Uh-huh.
You could do that sort of a thing.
Kind of like a spoken wheel system where like the center of the wheel is the main series that's potentially weekly or bi-weekly. And then you have like, yeah, like you said, break-offs that kind of go on for, you know, short duration. Because the thing what readers often will worry about is, oh, they're going to spin this off, and then, you know, they'll spin this off, and now we're up to six books again, you know?
Well, yeah, if it's here is a story arc that's got a clear end goal, and it will weave back into the main book. Now, maybe it breaks out again, but it's something that the main X book, you're always coming and going to the X-Men mansion or whatever.
Uh-huh.
But then you've got ways to branch out and fold back in to where, if you want to follow the X-Men, you've got a clear go-to thing. And if you're going to do it weekly, keep the price down. You've got to go $2.99 or less.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, it's a non-starter. But by having, well, I've got this group of X-Men over here, this other group over here, and this third and fourth and fifth book. I mean, things like Generation X, it just ended because it why go read that? They're not the real X-Men.
Yeah.
And it comes down to a lack of a flagship title. I mean, at one point, there were four Spider-Man books, and stories would rotate between them. And Amazing would sell the best, and Spectacular would sell about half that, and Amazing, or Friendly Neighborhood, and whatever the other one was, maybe Web of, or what have you, I forget what they were at the time, and maybe they were just the three, but anyways, two of the titles would be, again, a third or half the sales of the flagship books. You could follow that, get every other couple of chapters or whatever, get the gist of what's going on.
Uh-huh.
You've got to be respectful of the fact that people are only going to want to dip their toes into the water versus be all in. It's just not financially viable for most people. And if you don't make it easy for them to be that casual fan, they can't be the casual fan. If they can't be the casual fan, they can never grow into the hardcore fan. If you've got to start as the hardcore fan, the barrier to entry is just too high.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a nature of just modern day storytelling. I had somebody asking me the other day in reference to the Solo movie, well, how much of Star Wars do I need to know to understand that movie? And it was on or before opening day, so I'm like, oh, don't know yet. But yeah, there's only so many movies, and if it's a good movie, it should be accessible.
That is true. And I will tell you, I haven't seen it. I'm actually going to go see it tomorrow. But technically, the timeline of that movie is before all the others, because it's when he's like in his 20s. So
actually, it's not before all of the others. It's before the classic trilogy, after the prequel trilogy, but before Rogue One.
Yeah, but we don't speak about the prequel trilogy because they're terrible. So that's that. Yeah,
but they're canon.
Yeah, no, I know. I just don't.
And they had some cool effects.
I don't ever like to acknowledge Jar Jar Binks. That's my prime thing in life.
Just don't throw out Yoda's really epic fight scene because of Jar Jar.
No, I know. I did add like aspects. Like the third one of those, I actually thought was pretty good. But there's just, yeah. We'll move on. But let's just...
when did we get to the point where people had to ask, which of these other 8 or 9 movies do I need to have gotten my doctorate on to understand this new movie that's just now coming out and wants to find an audience?
Oh, it sounds like Marvel Comics. That sounds about right.
Well, even with Saga, I don't know if you were to jump in on Volume 8 of the trades, if you would really understand it all.
Yeah, that's a very good point.
And ongoing storylines, I'm of the sort that I need to read it from the beginning just because, well, I want to get the whole story. Yeah. But to do that, if I know I'm going into a multi-trade or whatever kind of a situation, or in the case of novels, a multi-book series, that's a significant investment in time. And if I'm going to read 5 trades or 5 prose novels or something, it's got to have a payoff at the end where I'm thinking this was worth that investment of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I've had a couple of cases where, wow, I'm getting through the books. I'm loving it. It's a great read. I'm having fun. It was worth it. I've had others, and there was, I forget which sci-fi novels it was. It was a series of 5 books that were at least 300 pages. So we're talking 1,500 pages of reading. That's a serious chunk of change in terms of time.
Mm-hmm.
All 4 of the first books ended on a to be continued kind of a, wait, you're leaving me here? And then I get to the end of the 5th and I'm like, that's what it built up to?
Mm-hmm.
Very disappointed. Whereas if you've got something that is almost a bit more like an episodic TV show, go in, have fun, enjoy it, get the next, get a benefit for having watched them all, but not have to feel like you've gotten your PhD on the whole thing and to understand any of the later ones. That's really the kind of storytelling we need on some of this stuff. You know, if you can't come into any one of these trades and have a shot of understanding kind of sort of who the characters are, maybe you need a little bit of a jumpstart with a previously on sort of a blurb at the beginning. But if you know who the X-Men are, if you know who Flash is or Superman or Batman or the Avengers or whatever, you should stand a chance of picking up almost any random trade, saying, okay, let me figure out where we're set. Okay, they've set up my status quo, and now I can go with the story, enjoy it, and have fun. Then you can be successful.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not the storytelling we're getting in most of these cases. And it's funny because while I personally am a fan of these kinds of books, if you go down to rank 87, we've got the Lazarus Sourcebook Collection Volume 1, which sold nearly 1,000 units, 992. But Lazarus has a world that is so defined, developed, whatever, there's actually a trade of sourcebook material on it.
I know, right?
And I love Rucka for doing this kind of stuff, because I love that his worlds are coherent, they are logical, they feel real as a result of this, the work he's done.
Uh-huh.
And I'm not going to say I've got these in the individual issues. I'm not going to say I've read them word for word. I'm way too lazy for that. But what I've read, I've enjoyed. It's clear he's thought it out, and I totally respect that. If you've ever had a chance to watch Rucka on a panel at a comic convention, when he's talking about one of these series he's done, be it Queen and Country, Lazarus, even Gotham Central, or other books like that, it's clear he's not one of these, he's just winging it and writing stuff and it goes where it goes. No, he's got a plan. And damn if it's not a really good one. And, you know, his work, I think, shows because of that. Which, of course, is the complete antithesis of an item a few levels down of the Commandy Challenge, which by its very design was one of those writers are riffing it from issue to issue to issue. It goes where it goes, and we'll see if it can make any sense at the end.
Yeah.
So there's a case for both sides of that. But I think for the average reader, if it just feels like it's going wherever the wind blows it, that's not a satisfying experience. Yet if it feels that you've got to have read something like a Lazarus sourcebook to have a chance of understanding Lazarus, which is absolutely not the case, but if it felt that way, that's going to hurt the sales of Lazarus.
Yeah.
It's just, with so many stories out there to be consumed, even if you had an infinite budget and an infinite amount of time, and let's face it, nobody has those, and an infinite amount of space to store all this stuff, Do you have the cognitive ability to juggle that many stories? I know that's certainly where I struggle at times.
Oh, I think that, you know, and that's part of the reason why people kind of jump on and off series. And, you know, you almost wonder if, you know, from our perspective, when we watch these sales numbers and the published perspective, that's like a bug. But if you really thought about it from the perspective of a pure reader, maybe that's a feature, because it's about the meritocracy, right? It's, if the story is good enough to keep my attention, I will continue purchasing it. When it becomes bad or boring, I will jump to something else, because there are 100 comics published each week. So on some level, this amount of availability really makes you compete, but stories that feel that might be good if they got to continue don't get to continue.
Do you think comics are a meritocracy?
Oh, no, I don't. I'm just saying, like, in terms of, you would agree, if you look 20 years ago at Marvel and DC, look at how long of runs creators used to get to go on, because the sales were steady, right? There's True. So much turnover now, and some of that is because people jump on and off books. Some of that is because of the boneheaded decisions DC and Marvel have done on renumbering and titling and yada yada. But some of it is just, I think, that people have a shorter attention span and they have other choices to spend their entertainment dollars and time on. And so I think that it's very hard to keep someone's attention. And maybe it should be. Maybe it should be hard, because you should have to earn it. Do you know what I mean? And I agree with you. Yeah, Marvel and DC obviously have a built-in advantage. So in the sense that it's easier to make those comics successful. And successful means sales, not necessarily good comics.
Yeah, but I think there are other examples you can go to. Some, if you go further back in time, others for that same period you were talking about, where you had creators doing really long runs, where there are titles where every arc was by a different creative team. I'm thinking Legends of the Dark Knight, JLA, JSA Classified, things of that sort. And what you can have with that, and I'm not going to say we necessarily did have it in all these cases, but you can have it to where if you've got a really good editor, that people are vying for that position, giving their A game, and you get a series of really good, amazing stories. Because there's only so many slots to go fill with, like, a Legends of the Dark Knight. You know, you got to hopefully pick and choose wisely of people who are pitching to you. And I think there was also an era, and maybe it's just in my imagination, I'd have to go check the credits on this, but early in my collection of the Justice League, it felt like they were switching writers on a seemingly routine basis, just of who had a good story to go tell or whatever. And it's not like you had, and again, I could be just totally misremembering this, it's not like you necessarily had, like, Jerry Conway writing it for, you know, an 8-year stretch or something.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly he was there for a long time, but I think there was a period on some of these titles where they had a bit more of, because it was more done in one or shorter stories, they could rotate different writers through as to who was available, who had a good story. But I think also at that point, the characters were more stable, that you could do that in a shared universe. A Thor story was a Thor story, and you could fit it within a couple of year range, and it would have worked equally well. Whereas now, because you've got these character arcs and major plot lines going on, it would be hard to fit in a kind of an inventory story in Superman or Batman or the X-Men or the Avengers. Because who is an Avenger from month to month to month or something? So I certainly think the nature of storytelling has impacted the sales, but I think the sales have impacted the storytelling as well. And I do feel we're on more of a downward spiral than an upward trend, but I also think that the reputation of these properties has gotten so infinitely better over the last 10, 15 years that it is disappointing that we're not seeing better sales, just overall. I mean, we've got from Marvel having a few movies out to this wildly popular Marvel Cinematic Universe, the DC TV shows. People know who most of these characters are now.
Mm-hmm.
Even the crazy obscure ones.
Well, and we've talked about a little about this in the past. We may be in a situation where comics is so niche and it's going to remain that way, and that the masses, all they need is a small little sampling every couple of years when the movies come out, and that's all they care about. They honestly don't need, you know how there's like occasional sports fans or occasional people that occasionally go to church but call themselves Catholic. They only go on Easter and Christmas.
Yeah.
It may be that people say that they love comic characters and they love them, but all they really need is to go see one movie a year, and they don't care about stepping a foot in the comic store, and that's good enough for them. Well, and that may be the reality.
And let's face it, there's usually a comic movie in the theater at all times these days.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because if it's not, you know, Black Panther or Avengers or Deadpool, it'll be Ant-Man and Wasp or whatever the hell is after that.
Yeah.
And if it's not all of that, they can turn on TV on CW any night of the week and watch some DC show. Or pull up Netflix and watch anything that's ever been produced, it seems like.
Yeah. You know, and you know, I'll give you another example. I consider myself a, I like to read prose novels as well as, you know, graphic novels and comics. And I read mysteries and thrillers. But I read like one a month, and that's good enough for me. You know, I don't go to mystery and thriller conferences, or, you know, they have those kind of things for the super fans. Same thing with romance, right? Romance, there's certain people that read 4 or 5 romance novels a week, and there are people that go to the conferences and things like that, and then there are people that read one book a year, and that's enough for them, you know?
Well, and that goes back to casual versus hardcore fans. Mm-hmm. Do you think comics are servicing either or both ends of that spectrum well?
Well, it's interesting you say that. When you say comics, I think comics are geared towards the hardcore fan, but I think the intellectual property is geared towards the mainstream, in terms of obviously the movies and TV are so successful, and they're making, that's where the majority of the money is made. And you have to say that those are being successful too, because they continue to draw people and continue to draw ever growing numbers of people in terms of, you know, the grosses for these movies, you know, continue to pile up. So it's an interesting double-edged question. I think for what me and you read, they do a decent job, if less and less so each year, job of giving us what we want. And maybe for the masses, they're doing a good job of giving them what they want. Maybe they have it figured out. We're just a little behind.
Well, certainly I think there are particular individuals who have things figured out. I'm going to go with Greg Berlanti as an example. Mm-hmm. He went from, and I don't know his full litany of all the projects he's done, but he got Arrow out there, and it's, I'll give it a shot. Okay, it's all right. And then he got Flash, and then there's Supergirl, there's Legends of Tomorrow, there's Black Lightning. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, he's got other projects out there.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure he's also the one behind the Deception TV show currently on ABC and a few other things. Now, not all of them are going to be, you know, surefire hits. Matter of fact, I think Deception's only lasting the one season, but he's got good enough grip on current TV storytelling and a good enough knowledge of, like, the DC universe to have a fairly good matchup with that and get some shows out. What I'm not seeing on the comic side is new titles coming out, or new branches of a franchise or corners of the universe, however you want to phrase it, that are really capturing the interest the way, say, the Arrowverse has on the CW.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'm not seeing that with, say, the New Age of Heroes or, Marvel Legacy or any of the other Marvel initiatives they're doing. And I think it's hard for somebody to be a casual fan of comic books and or trades. Certainly, I think it's easy to be that way of either TV shows or the movies. But even that may be less so, because, again, you've got people asking about Star Wars films. How much of this do I need to know? In other words, feeling like they can't be a casual fan.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how somebody can make it to this point in life and not have seen a Star Wars film, because I actually had somebody tell me that the other day. I honestly don't understand that. This person has not been living in a cave, which I thought was the only explanation, because there have been so many opportunities to see Star Wars. But, you know, if they've got other stuff going on in their life or just aren't that interested in it, that's cool. Just surprising from my vantage point in life.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I was of that age to see Star Wars as a kid and just really got on board with the property early on and at the right time. And it's life in my life. You know, not one of those people who grew up with Jar Jar and so forth as the entry point.
Mm-hmm.
And even Jar Jar is not that bad. But we'll get away from that.
We'll have to disagree.
I'm not saying he's that great. I'm just saying.
Yeah. You always were the more positive of us, too. So we'll continue that trend.
Yeah. I just am not seeing the inroads and the on-ramps into trade sales or even the monthly sales that would go along, that ought to have gone along with the increase in popularity of these properties and characters.
Mm-hmm. I see that. And I wonder if part of our problem is we're not seeing sales in certain aspects like the bookstore and Amazon. And that's why you see a little bit more of DC reaching out with their OGNs and the stuff marketed to kids, and then, you know, Boom and their sales there and things like that. I wonder if we had more visualization of those sales, we'd see a little bit more growth and be a little bit more positive, you know what I mean, in terms of collected editions. Because, you know, there is just a lot of chatter all the time about how the collected edition for young reader material is a very up and coming market. You know what I mean?
No, I think that's a great point, because I think things like Star Wars titles or even Star Trek titles would probably do well in the mass market, where Star Wars and Star Trek fans that aren't comic fans can encounter them if they go to a bookstore. The question is how many people are doing that. Also, in other areas, I would expect certain properties to be doing very well. I'm thinking specifically, let's say, the Scholastic market.
Oh, yeah.
With things such as the DC Superhero Girls and or Miraculous or Moon Girl or Ms. Marvel, or things that are skewing to a more maybe a female readership that isn't making its way into comic stores. And if they did, wouldn't always feel welcome there.
Yeah. And also, you know, we talk all the time, and I know you do. You talked with some of your other co-hosts about one of the hard parts about these 20-page single-issue comics is they don't necessarily tell a complete story, and that everything is geared towards the trade, and that can make it difficult. And, you know, the way that they organize story now, when there's, you know, when you're doing stories for young readers and you're doing them, you know, knowing that it's going to be primarily selling in the book market, you know, I bet that those stories are written and produced with a beginning, middle, and an end, even if it is a continuing, you know, chapter series, but they're much more so, you know, where you lament that not being the case in single issues today, there might be a lot of that going on in just the young reader market.
Yeah. And I think how you end an issue makes a huge difference. Mm-hmm. Is it a downbeat? Well, geez, that's depressing kind of a note. That doesn't make me want to come back. Or is it a cheap cliffhanger where you told me a lot of a story, but now you've are trying to almost Shanghai me into the next issue, not really earn it, but I don't want to say steal it, but you know what I mean.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's one thing if something ends, and Babylon 5, the TV show, did a great job on this. It would often end on a bit of a revelation, not a dun-dun-dun, oh my god, but a,
yeah.
Hey, wait a sec, now you've got me rethinking something. And it gave you something to chew on, but most stories aren't that able to withstand a going back and thinking through the storyline and having it come out with a better read of the story than you did on the first read, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, imagine if you were watching, say, Back to the Future. Oh, he did all this, time change, he gets to the end, okay, we're good. And then you rewatch it, and you realize, oh, they said time change, but nothing did. And of course, that's not what happens in the movie. There are Easter eggs to get on a second viewing. But there are a lot of stories where they know who the villain is, they go after the villain, they defeat the villain. You read it again, and it's like, I know this is all coming, and there's no nuances, no deeper material, no plan to be, oh, I see what's going on, kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
When I was getting into, again, Babylon 5, which is, I believe, going to start up in June, I think, on Amazon Prime.
Oh, interesting. They finally brought it over there. Okay.
Yeah. There was a website called The Lurker's Guide to Babylon 5,
mm-hmm.
and I was traveling a lot, so I had some time in the evenings to surf the net or whatever, and it was basically a annotated guide to the episodes. Oh, they did this. This comment here that this guy made that you thought was an offhand remark is really referencing this past thing or foreshadowing something that's coming up. Here's where there's a callback to this. Here's what really seems to be going on here, whatever. And it was like having a guided view or whatever of the story. Now, I would watch the episode, I would read that, and I'd rewatch the episode. And I'm like, oh, I did miss that. That's interesting. I've got a new appreciation for the story.
Mm-hmm.
That's something that rewards the reader for paying attention, for being there, for actively participating with the story versus just passively consuming it. A lot of comic stories, I don't think, have that level of depth and meat to it.
Mm-hmm.
The same is true for TV shows and movies in some cases. You know, if you get to the end and that's what it built up to is your reaction, not a good thing. But because of a lot of these stories going out there and doing okay, but not, wow, that's amazing, there's not that buzz on a lot of these things that by the time they hit the trade side is encouraging people, man, I have just got to pick this up.
Yeah.
It's out. I'm interested. I'll pick it up whenever.
And then it might get lost in the sea of all the other stuff being released. And then, you know.
Absolutely.
Well, and also, along with that, because it's all based on pre-orders, the retailers are taking a risk. So they have to order conservatively. And then so if something is a hit, then they have to reorder. And because it was under-ordered, the printing discounts the provide, you know, they can get, it's all, you know, we've talked about it before. It's like a self-feeding cycle.
Yeah. And if you get to the point where you've got something that people are actually actively taking notice of, you do well, and that's where the trades start to benefit you. Mm-hmm. That's why we see things like the Saga showing up on the list. Another one where I think we've got every volume of the trade showing up on the list is Mighty Morphin Power Rangers. Now, mm-hmm. we've got to go a little below 300 to get that one of those issues. But the fifth one is the best-selling, followed by the first, the second, the third, and then the fourth. So again, a bit of a V-shape to that, although skewed more towards the end than the beginning and such. And it's not like this is just flying off store shelves, because on average, you know, not every store got a copy. But it's one where we're actually seeing all of the trades showing up on the list, which is not something we see for a lot of titles.
Oh, absolutely. And the fact that it got to, you know, volume 5 speaks to at least some staying of power.
Well, and I think the storyline they've kicked off with the Shattered Grid is definitely going to get stuff going into volume 6 and 7 doing well on this and when they collect the Go-Go Power Ranger stuff.
Gotcha.
So they've told a story that is at least getting Power Ranger fans to take notice, and that's really what it comes down to. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've got a base, are you serving that base well, and are they liking what you're doing? Mm-hmm. If we go down to rank 300, we see that the list is at that point bottoming out at 322 units. So really, if 1 in 10 stores orders a copy, you're on the list. Again, depending how many actual stores are out there. I haven't counted them all, haven't been to them all. It'd be fun to do if I had spare time and like to travel that much. But then if we go down to rank 500, because we've got all the way down to there, we get down to 198 units. Mm-hmm. So really, you can do moderate sales and show up on the list with reorder activity and such. In this case, we had a multi-way tie there at the bottom. Mm-hmm. So we had as far down as 504 items on the list, and that happened to be Thanos Infinity Revelation original graphic novel, doing another 198 units, getting up to 11,027 for its total accumulated sales over its three, four times on the list. So there are certain things that are doing well. There are other things that not so much. Mm-hmm. And we've got a fair amount of reorder activity, more as you go further down the list, as one should expect. It would be rather disappointing if the reorder was topping the list and the new stuff was at the bottom.
Oh, that would be very bad, actually.
Definitely would be a bit depressing.
Yeah, because then you'd probably be worried about the companies, you know, 6 months from them, because if they weren't, you know, the business models, a lot of times, you know, your current stuff and obviously your backlist kind of subsidizing the going forward production. So if they weren't selling well, we'd be a little worried in a few months in terms of what they're able to have revenue to put out new series.
Absolutely. If people are more excited about the older material than the current stuff, that is the kiss of death.
Yeah.
And it's, at some point we may hit that.
Yeah, the direct market. We'll see.
Well, to your point earlier, when you've got things like Amazon, is the direct market for trades as needed as it once was? I think this material between Amazon and digital is wildly more accessible potentially outside of the direct market than inside the direct market. Yet certainly on individual issues, the direct market is still the lion's share of the sales.
Mm-hmm.
And from what I'm hearing, digital is kind of sort of flatlined. It's not like gone or anything, but it's not continuing to grow like it was for the first couple of years of it. So I think if you're looking for trades or digital to really be that white knight and new major revenue stream, we're not on that path at the moment, but it wouldn't take a whole lot for that to change. I don't know what I would recommend to these publishers at this point to get to where some of these items are just selling a bit more impressively.
Mm-hmm.
if we filter the list to just new Marvel and DC stuff, we see a fair number of items that are doing okay, but not brilliantly. We've got like Cable Volume 1 doing under 1,000 units, same with Iceman Volume 2, a few things like that. A lot of these other things are not current-ish material. They are some older material. But I think some of that makes sense, particularly with X-Men Legion Quest and Legion supporting the Legion TV show that's currently airing its second season on Fox, I think it is. But then I look at, you know, Spider-Gwen, almost 1,800 units. Deathstroke, about 1,900, a little over. Those are doing all right. Enough to warrant continuing with the stuff, but not enough to say, wow, this is a smash hit. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I would have expected more items on the list, having filtered it this way, than I'm seeing. But some of that just goes to maybe it was an off month for when they were releasing some stuff. Mm-hmm. But when you've got things like Batman Volume 5, Rules of Engagement, and Star Wars Darth Vader Volume 2 doing, in Batman's case, almost 5,600, and Darth Vader's case, 4,400 units, those are pretty strong sales for trades these days.
Well, and I think that, I mean, it's tough to make generalizations about Batman just because it's almost like it's its own, it's a machine with like inertia and seemingly unending ability to just keep adding titles. But, and obviously right now they have a strong creative team for sure. And obviously being that that's their most popular book, they will always keep a strong creative team on it. But I think Tom King is doing a good job with, you know, the realities of the market and then the double shipping and all that. So it's interesting. Will there be a point when Batman is not impervious to the market? You know, we'll see. We'll see.
Well, I think right now, one, Batman is Batman. He's a unique character in that respect, got some definite sales juice. But also the main storyline they're telling with the upcoming wedding and stuff is almost the equivalent of clickbait. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things they don't do as often as killing or unkilling a character. But we saw the same thing when Superman got married, when Spider-Man got married. And at some point, there's inevitably going to be the unmarriage sort of a storyline where it's like, yeah, it's no longer the status quo. Whether they get divorced or just never had have married, I don't know yet. But at some point, that'll happen.
Yeah.
But I do think there are a couple of properties that just do play by their own rules. Certainly Batman is one of them. What's interesting is it seems to have had that over time, whereas others, there are durations where, man, Spider-Man is just doing gangbusters or the Avengers under Bendis or something like that, but it doesn't have that long-term kind of sales juice.
Uh-huh.
And it goes back to it's a fickle market and not only brand awareness, but creator awareness. You get a hot creator off a book, it may drop like a stone. It's flip side, you get a hot creator on a book and it can skyrocket.
Mm-hmm. That's why I'm interested to see how the Bendis moving to DC. Has anything come out in the comic side on that yet?
No, the last thing I think they shipped was the Superman special, which is before Man of Steel. Mm-hmm. Next, we're going to get the 6-issue weekly Man of Steel series, which is Bendis, and it's got, man, just some phenomenal artists on that. I'm really looking forward to that, particularly because of what they teased in the DC Nation Zero and Action Comics 1000.
Yeah, and I obviously like expect DC to pull out all the stops. They're gonna do a bunch of marketing. They're gonna do a bunch of pushing, and obviously like the once a week thing will help. I think the initial sales for all that stuff will be good. I'm actually more interested in 6 months what Bendis's sales at DC are, because I think, you know, the companies have proven over the short term that they know how to juice sales short term.
Absolutely,
like one to 3 months. You know what I mean? Either double shipping, double pages. You know, big blowout ads and different things. Who knows if those are successful? But they can juice things for a little bit. But 6 months out, when he's in the middle of an arc, I'd be interested to see those sales.
I think once we hit either Action Comics 1007 or Superman 7, yeah, where we're starting that second arc, presuming there's not a new big major artist introduced or something, yeah, how things are doing at that point, out of that honeymoon period and yeah, into kind of, is it stabilizing or not?
Yeah.
And I'll be honest, prior to having read Action Comics 1000 and the DC Nation stuff, I was skeptical if Bendis's storytelling style over at Marvel or even on Powers, how well that would translate to Superman and DC. But what I've read, I've enjoyed. I think it's some great stuff. But does it capture the attention long term? I mean, we're talking 6-7 months in. Does it do it for more than just the initial big splash? I think it has a chance. And if this is the start of a multi-year run that he's got on Superman and he's just doing some exciting stuff and it re-energizes people about the character, if that can get Superman up towards the range of Batman sales, that gives DC a pretty good 1-2 punch. Then they can go take a look at either Wonder Woman or some other characters and say, okay, can we juice that up a little bit? Because I think what they're doing on Wonder Woman's a lot of fun these days, but it's also not lighting up the sales charts.
Yeah.
It's a question of, can they do both at the same time? And I'd like to see that.
Mm-hmm. It will be interesting.
Yeah. Like I said, there's always something new coming down the line that makes me question what's stuff going to look like in a couple of months.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you get some things that are clear, strong sellers and have some legs to them, and they stay that way for a while. Otherwise, you get some stuff that's a big splash, and then poof, it's gone next time. Because, like, again, with that Action Comics 80 Years of Superman, with sales over 18,000, do we think we're likely to see this showing up with reorder activity? And I'm going to say probably not.
Yeah.
And again, I go back to your comment of they bought enough to hold them for a while. Which, yeah. Again, not a bad plan.
Yeah, and I think that's a low-risk title, whereas others, like, Batman Volume 5, well, from Rules of Engagement, one that just came out, well, you know, those are healthy sales. The recent reorder may not be high because, as DC has proven with the New 52, in 2 to 3 years, DC may, you know, not start over, but may do another sort of reboot. And so the comic stores have to be careful about ordering things that can become dead stock.
I would hope, particularly after Rebirth and starting up with like a Man of Steel sort of a thing, that we get some stability in the DC continuity for a while. I mean, I'm expecting fallout out of Doomsday Clock.
Yeah.
And I'm expecting a reversion to more pre-Flashpoint. But if you look at the last couple of years where they killed off Superman, we got a new Superman, he's got to find his way with Batman and Superman and the others, and oh wait, now he's been there the whole time, and now we're getting a Man of Steel. It feels like the backstory is a little too much in flux, and they need to calm that down, otherwise you're right. If DC gets a reputation of give it a half year and it'll be irrelevant, that kills the incentive for retailers to invest too heavily in anything, or readers for that matter. And that's just a bad situation.
Absolutely.
But I think that's funny because at one point, the shared universe was that stability. Those things had that longer shelf life. And the more creator-owned or whatnot, that was the more here today, gone tomorrow. Yet now it's almost the exact opposite, where they're doing so much status quo changes for these characters. Reading what came out 5 years ago for these characters is irrelevant, yet you can pick up some stuff of some fairly old material that is surprising to see pop up on the list years after it came out.
Mm-hmm.
The one I'm looking at right now in particular is at rank 106 with Global Frequencies Deluxe Edition hardcover, 860 units. That's almost a 20-year-old property. It was a 12-issue limited, or I don't know if it was meant to be a limited series, but it was a 12-issue series. It was really well done.
Oh, I love that series. In fact, this is like one of the times that DC got me to double dip. I had the paperback, but I wanted the hardcover, so I bought the hardcover and I gave the paperback to one of my friends.
You know what I want to see the DC Universe streaming channel do, or service do? There is a pilot for Global Frequency.
Interesting.
I think they should get to where they're showing pilots for that, the Justice League sitcom that never came out, things of those sort. Take the other otherwise dead properties of movie and TV for DC,
mm-hmm.
and get those on there. Fill out your library that way. If you are the go-to place of, you know, I really want to go watch the old Shazam live-action show of the 70s or cartoons or whatever, that's where to go.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? Maybe they'll do that. Maybe they won't. I don't know.
I should have known that you like Global Frequency because most of those stories are one and done. So I should have had an inkling.
They're one and done, but they're also a really cool concept of there's 1,001 experts or whatever out there. And if you need somebody who is just an expert in this crazy niche little thing and happens to be within proximity of the major event you're trying to avert or whatever,
mm-hmm.
they get called in and stuff like that. It's something that I think I think they should do another attempt at getting that on the air. Because you could do almost a Mission Impossible-esque anyone's a hero kind of approach to it.
Absolutely.
And make it work. Mm-hmm. I've actually seen the pilot for that. It's been ages, but it was fun. It was good. So like I said, hopefully they'll be able to get that on that DC Universe streaming service, as well as plenty of other stuff.
Yeah, if they have the rights, yeah, for sure. And, well, it'll be interesting to see what they kind of populate that with. I know they obviously have, they've talked about a lot of what they're planning on, but, you know, as they kind of roll it out, they'll find out what works and what doesn't. So
I think there are enough older material that they should be able to finagle the rights to, because it's ultimately their material in many cases, not so much with Global Frequency, again, creator-owned, I believe. But it would be good to get that stuff to where it's in front of an audience, potentially.
Do you think we'll get the old Batman episodes? Adam West?
I think they absolutely should do that. Yeah. The Wonder Woman series with Linda Carter. Yeah. Every version of Superman that's ever been on the air, even the serials, what the hell?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a streaming service. Get the stuff, put it out there.
Yeah, that's a good point.
It's not they've only got 24 hours they can fill.
Yeah, it's been a long time since I watched the episodes of that Batman, man. That's been a while.
I've got the full DVD collection. I just haven't popped them out. but I picked that up when it was out there.
Yeah, I used to watch them, and they would run them on the weekends, and then sometimes in the afternoons you get home from school, you could watch a couple episodes. They were great when I was a kid.
Well, when I was a kid, too, they were out there, catch them in the afternoon and such. How much of that do you think has led to kind of Batman being what Batman is now? We all grew up having either watched that show or a cartoon of one sort or another.
Uh-huh. Be it
the Super Friends, the Batman animated series, the Batman Tarzan Adventure Hour or whatever. Batman's been ubiquitously on the air in some form or fashion forever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it makes people more predisposed to, hey, I know that character. He's cool. I'm going to check it out.
Yeah, no, nothing wrong with exposure. That's for sure.
I think that's also what led to the X-Men being popular at a certain point of time, is there was that Fox cartoon. Catchy theme song, good version of the characters.
Yeah, I watched that all the time. That was a great show.
So I think that's where, even though we're not seeing the benefit now, things like the Marvel movies and such may benefit comics 10 years from now, as kids that have grown up watching those movies and thinking they're cool discover comics.
Mm-hmm.
If comics are still there to be discovered. I freely admit it's not a foregone conclusion.
Yeah. Interesting times.
It is. So was there anything else on the list that kind of caught your attention?
No, I primarily, focused on the interesting grouping of sagas. And then I did notice the X-Men Grand Design, which was kind of that kind of project I forget what is his name. Ed Piskor did. Kind of condensing the entire X-Men history. Well, there's going to be two parts. This is the first part
Three parts,
yeah.
Yeah, I was not crazy about the art style, but man, respect to that guy for the research he did and the phenomenal job he did stitching all of it together into such a cohesive overview of the characters.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you talk about that, the art style is, some of his previous work, like Hip Hop Family Tree from Fantagraphics, that's his style. So it's probably just like it's obviously his choice, but in terms of how people react to it differently. And I also think that what I've heard interviews of him talking about that is that he really loves the 1970s Marvel Treasury editions, the size of those and things like that. And he came to them, and that's why he chose that like color palette, the type of paper and all that. So that's kind of like, it is like almost an homage to that.
Yeah, and again, it's if you're going to spend that kind of time and effort doing it, do whatever works for you, absolutely. What's interesting is not only did Grand Design hit the list with that trade, rank 11 with 3,850 units, but if you go way down the list below 300 to 306, we've got the X-Men, Uncanny X-Men Official Index of the Marvel Universe.
Mm-hmm.
And that's collecting the Official Index of the Marvel Universe 1 through 13, which is no doubt one of the reference things he probably used to put that together. Marvel has done quite a bit of work doing indexes of their titles, who's in what, was the first appearance of this, that, and the other character or device or storyline or what have you. I'm not going to say it's an exciting read. It is very dry documentary in not even a narrative form. But it's information rich in that respect. And it is kind of cool that there are these reference points if you want to go find out, you know, when did Cyclops' brother first show up, and things of that sort. But yeah, there's a second one of the Pisker miniseries being solicited, I think, in the current previews, and that covers from, I think, Giant Size X-Men to some point, and then there'll be a more modern take or whatever.
Uh-huh.
And I'm curious how all of that's going to fit in, because I don't know when this second stage of his stuff, what the cutoff point is for that. Because you hit the point where from Giant Size on, there hits a point where you start getting multiple titles coming out, and then more than just multiple titles, you get like a half dozen or a dozen titles coming out in the X-Men franchise.
Okay.
And I don't know how much of all of that he's got in his research. Because obviously the stuff still coming out isn't going to get all factored in. But I don't know. We'll see. It's going to be interesting to see if he also starts including Alpha Flight and some of the other offshoot properties.
Uh-huh.
But certainly if you're a fan of X-Men, it's and you want to know the history of the characters, you've got to pick up Grand Design. So what else? Anything else of...
No, I was just, you know... Like I said, I was talking about the saga, and then I saw that one and wanted to mention that. And nothing else really jumped out at me. I saw that the Mighty Morphin Power Rangers, and we already talked about that. And yeah.
There is a Savage Dragon trade here on the list, Merging of Multiple Earths, which sounds like a Crisis on Infinite Earths, sort of a... don't know if it is or not. It collects 223 to 227 of Savage Dragon. It sold 200 units.
Oh, wow.
So, certainly Savage Dragon falls into that passion project sort of thing. A little, it's got to be frustrating for a creator when their stuff first hits trade and it does, like, 200 units. That's not that much.
I mean, obviously, hopefully selling some in the non-direct market, but, you know, a lot of times we see the corollary of it doesn't sell well in the direct market, it generally doesn't sell well in the rest of the market either, so.
Well, and another one a few ranks above it is Port of Earth Volume 1. Its initial trade, now this is reorder activity, so doing 200 units isn't too bad, but it's at 2,700 units all said and done. That's one that if it does well enough at the beginning, and it seems to be that it'll probably go for a while, but really that's not going to hit the big time unless it becomes like a TV show or something like that. And certainly I think its format lends itself to that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, when you've got other stuff that it is new and just showing up around 2,000 or 200 units, I mean, Eric Larson's been around the block. He's done a lot of stuff. He's got other income coming in, no doubt, from royalties on other projects and stuff. He's doing Savage Dragon because he wants to. I cannot imagine he's doing it for the money. And I envy him being in that position. He's able to do that. I think that's awesome.
Absolutely.
So let's see, looking at the price points. Almost three quarters of the items were at $20 or below. Actually, three quarters exactly were at $20 or below. One quarter of the items were above that. We had a few items at $75, $125, or $150. Let's go take a look real quick at what those are, just out of curiosity. No doubt they are omnibus type stuff. So we've got a Green Lantern and the Silver Age Omnibus Volume 2, Joe Kubert, Tarzan and the Lion Man Artist Edition. Preacher Volume 3 Absolute, Carnage Omnibus, Superman Exile and Other Stories Hardcover, X-Men Legion Quest, Marvel Masterwork Avengers Volume 18, wow, 18 volumes of that, and then Harley Quinn and the Gotham City Sirens Omnibus, with the Preacher being the $150 item.
Mm-hmm.
So, a fair number of high-ticket items this time around, but I think there's a definite market for that. And I think that's something that is a good way to keep your hardcore collectors kind of engaged and happy, is if you take stuff they're excited about and do a nice kind of coffee table edition of it.
Absolutely.
I personally kind of think those are more for showing off than reading. But that's just because of the weight factor.
Yeah.
And if you do get one of these, if it's your first one, do check out the weight capacity, storage capacity of your coffee table before actually setting it down. Lest it collapse on some of these, because some of these are like 1,000 pages or something crazy.
Yeah, they're very big.
But there is stuff that I think is cool to collect that way. I used to get the Masterworks when they first came out. I got off them when they were probably about half the price they are now.
Yeah, now they're up about $75 a pop, aren't they?
Yeah, they're $75 now. They started at $35 or $40.
Jeez. Whew.
I just found I was never having the time to get into them and read them and such, and I was spending enough on new comics that they just stopped having the need for it.
Well, and also the other thing too is now with Marvel Unlimited, all those you point was to be able to read that material, whereas before it was, you know, it was exceedingly difficult to find it in published format. Now with Marvel Unlimited, when they publish those, they also put them on the Marvel Unlimited app. So you can, for $9.99 a month, or if you get the year subscription, it's like $6 and something cents a month, you can read all that material, you know?
Well, so. And that's one of the reasons I do think it's good that they continue to collect older materials to get it digital ready.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's good, mainly for Marvel with their digital stuff, but I think also, once I think both Marvel and DC, if Image were not an umbrella publisher, but were an actual publisher, I would say it'd be good for them too. But to go get all of your back material over time into reprintable format, because there's that point where you were a non-digital pre-press, and I don't think necessarily everything from, say, the 80s and back is something that they could just, you know, okay, we're ready to reprint this for whatever reason and it have it ready. So if I were them, I would allocate some of the production staff to continuing to go get that older stuff ready.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because as you hit things like Adam Strange showing up on Krypton, well, geez, why not do some collections of Adam Strange stuff? For that matter, why not do Tales of Krypton or something as some collected editions? There's I think, a lot of older material that is increasingly relevant based on the movies, TV shows, and comic stories that are being told that they could and should be collecting and could do as well or better than some of their new material getting collected.
Yeah.
So anything else? Does that pretty much do it?
I think that does it for us this month.
Cool.
The show notes and forum for this podcast can be found at www.comicbookpage.com under the podcast and forum sections of the website. The sales estimates can be found under the sales chart section of the Comic Book Page website. Please email us at themailreport@comicbookpage.com and let us know what you think of what was discussed in this episode. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed by Don Mayo and his guests are their own and may or may not accurately reflect reality in any way, shape, or form. If you differ from your reality, please verify that you are in the same space-time continuum before taking any action. All numbers given are estimates and only estimates. To think otherwise would be foolish. The estimates given are for sales from publishers to retailers for items invoiced through Diamond Comics Distribution for the month in question. The Diamond Order Index only goes 2 decimal places, and therefore there is a margin of error of at least 1/10,000th of the estimate for the key title, which is usually, but not always, Batman. For months in which no issue of Batman shipped, Detective Comics is usually used as the key title. Some numbers are rounded to the nearest 100 for convenience. This may introduce a further level of inaccuracy. No information about how many copies may or may not have sold to readers is included, implied, or denied. Anywhere from all of the units shipped to retailers to none of them could still be sitting on store shelves gathering dust. All reorder activity should be seen only as indications there is at least one retailer that may have an excessive amount of empty shelf space with dust it needs collecting. The list of the top 300 comic books only contains the top 300 comic books sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 300 different comic books may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 300 comic books for the month. The list of the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions only contains the top 100 graphic novels and collected editions sold through Diamond to retailers for the month in question. More than 100 different graphic novels and collected editions may have shipped during the month, and obviously not all of them will be included on the list of top 100 graphic novels and collected editions for the month. In the past, the list of top graphic novels and collected editions contained only 50, 25, or SKUs and items. This means that historical data about graphic novels and collected editions is increasingly limited the further back in time that you look. Fixing this may require time travel, which, as far as I know now, has not been successfully invented in the past, present, or any possible or probable future. No visibility into the sales or lack of sales of any comic books, graphic novels, and or collected editions that are not listed on the top 300 comic books or top 100 graphic novels and collected editions lists is included, implied, or denied. The data from Diamond only contains data from Diamond. No information about the sales or lack of sales of any items sold outside the Diamond Comics distribution channel is included, implied, or denied. That information is considered to be outside the scope of this report. If this isn't the data you're looking for, then this isn't the data you're looking for, and no amount of whining will change that. If you don't know why this disclaimer's here, then it probably isn't meant for you. This report is void in the ultimate reality of Duluth, Minnesota. Ath logic and the English language itself seem to work very differently there.